It's good to return to my home away from home. The season was very different the last time I was here. It's delightful coming to the seminary because you can pack an entire different suitcase filled with clothes, depending on the season. As always, it's an honor to be here and address all of you. And for me, of course, there's nothing more enjoyable than talking about Shakespeare. So I've arrived this time to talk about one of the more obscure plays. This is not a play that is that well known, even among many who are very familiar with Shakespeare and enjoy Shakespeare. It's a play that was not often produced. It was popular in its time, but then fell out of favor for a number of decades, but has become increasingly popular again just in the last few years when it was discovered that it is a great stage piece. And I know that you saw the TV production last night, which I think is very well done, quite restrained, very restrained in its way, and very much adapted to the medium of television. On stage, the performances can be bigger, more theatrical, but I think the TV production gave you a sense of the play. But what I really want to begin talking about tonight is the fact that it may seem very strange for all of us as Catholics, and particularly here at a seminary, to be speaking about one of Shakespeare's comedies during Lent. We are all very aware of the season. The season is of great importance within the liturgical year. And it might, in one way, seem inappropriate to be discussing this play at this time, in that it is one of his most magnificent comedies. It is filled with wit and gentle humor. As in all of his comedies, it gives us a clear vision of human foibles, the way in which human beings continually prove that they're human. And for those of us who read or sit in the audience, we get the joy of laughing at other people being human. But during the process, we hope, learning something about ourselves. But in another way, Love's Labour's Lost is indeed a Lenten play. It is unlike any other play that Shakespeare himself ever wrote, and it's unlike almost any other comedy ever written, in that Shakespeare himself shocks us at the end of the play by not giving us the necessary end to complete the comic structure. We basically have a comedy that seems comic, that is moving us to a particular point in which the final comic resolution is at first seemingly overturned, but then delayed, and the play ends on a very curious note. In fact, what I'm going to call tonight a Lenten note. And in that sense, I'm going to make the claim that even though it is a comedy, and a golden comedy, and a delightful comedy, it is appropriate. Because the lessons that the play finally teach us are lessons not dissimilar from those lessons that the season of Lent should teach us. Now, that's one of the curiosities. The second curiosity about the play is this. Of all of Shakespeare's plays, this is the one probably most rooted in his own time. It is a play written somewhere. Scholars disagree the exact year in which it was written. We know it was an early comedy. We know it came early in his career. There are some who claim it was his first comedy. Probably not. There are some who claim it was written as late as 1595 or 6. Probably not. Whole careers have been spent arguing these points. I'll talk a little later tonight about pedantry. But it's the stuff of pedantry arguing when exactly the play was written. But the fact of the matter is we know it's early. We know it was probably revised. That is, there was probably an early version that he then rewrote for a later performance because we have the curiosity of some aspects of it that clearly reflect his very earliest writing and other moments that also clearly reflect the more mature master, the man who was coming into his own, and at some point the play was revised. But at the same time, it is a play of the 1590s. Why are we looking at it 400 years later? Well, for one thing, because it is a delightful piece of work, a superior piece of work, and it comes from that remarkable intellect, that great creative genius, who always has lessons to teach us. But more importantly, I think there is something that speaks to us, and you probably had a sense of this last night in watching the play, that this is a play obsessed with what late 16th century, the 1590s, was obsessed with, and that is the power of language. And there is a way in which this play is a play about words themselves, how words move us, how we use words, and how we can misuse words, how words can mislead us as well. And all the way through the play, it happens over and over again, the language becomes so intricate that there had to be moments as you were viewing the play last night when your ear simply got lost. You simply could not follow what the characters were saying. What you have there is a battle of wits that is so profound, using the weapons of the day, and that was language. It was an age that was obsessed with language, so that we are getting puns on puns on puns of words and phrases and ideas and personalities that were very popular in the 1590s. Much of it seems, in one sense, to be lost to us. Part of it can be enjoyable simply for its own sake. There is a moment that comes early on in the fifth act when there is a little exchange between Rosaline and Catherine, in which the two ladies are attacking each other verbally. And they're back and forth, line after line after line. I won't go through the little exchange, but when it's done, the princess says, "Well bandied both." This is Act 5, Scene 2, about line 29. "Well bandied both, a set of wit well played." And the image is of a tennis match. And the other characters have been sitting, watching, as if they were watching a really fine game of tennis being played, as the ball was batted back and forth over the net without one of the players missing a return or missing the ball, and each return a little bit better than the one before. And indeed, what was happening on the stage and what happens in this play and what is necessary to understand for our time what's going on in the play is that the audience, as well as the characters on the stage themselves, are watching the equivalent of a great game of tennis played by masters, in which you may not understand the form, you may not understand the musculature going into knocking some of those returns back over the net, but you can appreciate that it's done at all. So in that sense, it may be rooted in its own time, but the play has much to say to us. And part of what it has to say is that there was a time when language was very important. The sad fact of the matter is language is disappearing. We are getting much slower on the uptake. The pool of words that we draw from is dwindling. Our ability to express ourselves is not what it was. I was recently teaching Romeo and Juliet in my Shakespeare class, and the prologue to that play speaks about the 2 hours traffic of the stage. And one of my students said, "They didn't actually do this whole play in 2 hours, did they?" And I said, "They probably did, but I'll bet any production today, even spoken at a fairly good clip, would take 2 hours and a half, 2 hours and 45 minutes. And the reason is our ears have slowed down. We cannot take language in anymore. And it gives us a sense of how those theater goers back in that time were able to absorb words with a rapidity of comprehension that is long gone. However, and this is the other point, if you brought them today and sat them down in front of Star Wars, they would not be able to comprehend what was happening on the screen because the images would be going by so fast. We now perceive through the eye and are able to take images in the way that the Elizabethan English took in words through the ear. There has been a great exchange of ear for eye and word for image. There's much that could be made about that, but that's for another talk another time. Let me just say it is a huge change. And when we try to keep up with the language of a play like Love's Labour's Lost, we can be aware of what has been lost as well. And part of that is our ability to comprehend language. It's vanishing. We're slower. We are neither as quick-witted nor as quick on the uptake as they once were. But the other thing, of course, is this is the way that the smart young express themselves. The games, the verbal games played by the young men and the young women in this play are essentially what the intelligentsia was doing at that time. If you were smart, if you were popular, if you wanted to show what you could do, if you wanted to be artistic, if you wanted to be well respected, if you wanted to show off either for your fellows or those around you, what you did was you wrote poetry, you wrote witty letters, you spoke in a fashion that was distinctly your own that others would mimic. It was a way of defining yourself, the means of defining yourself at the time. It was, if you will, the art form of the time, just as certainly as today among the young. If you want to define yourself, if you want to be well thought of, if you want to impress those around you, you get a guitar and you plug it in, okay? Or you get a set of drums and you start pounding on it. There is a reason why self-definition, artistically, now begins in that way. And every 12, 13, 14-year-old dreams of being what they call, and I'm using the word loosely, a musician. I think it's probably closer to being an electrician, where you can find the plug, find the outlet, and make some noise. But the fact of the matter is, I mean, in one sense, I'm making a joke, but that was the equivalent. I mean, if you want to impress those around you, then you form your own group. And you are going to make something out of yourselves. You're going to show the stuff you're made of. You're going to make your mark. Well, of course, the mark you're making is the same as everybody else's. And there is a kind of joke here in that these young men in Love's Labour's Lost are going to make their mark, and they're making their mark verbally, and they're writing and speaking just like everybody else at the time was writing and speaking, although Shakespeare occasionally will give them something exceptional. These are intelligent young men. And the other thing we must say is that the level of making your mark then, impressing others, was somewhat higher. It is more difficult to write a sonnet than to compose a rock song. That's just a fact. And it has to do with the demands of the form. It is not easy to write a sonnet. It's much more difficult, as the characters in Love's Labour's Lost often do, to speak sonnets spontaneously. You know, that may be what we call poetic license. But when you've got Shakespeare signing your poetic license, it gets you into a lot of places. You can go a long way with it. In any case, this is a work very much rooted in its own time. But the point I'm making is any time, any place essentially has young people trying to do what the young men at the beginning of this play are trying to do. They live in a world that somehow is going to be defined by what they do. But what they do will be what the world tells them to do. They will, it's a curious exchange. For them, in one sense, what the world is telling them to do is to be intellectual, be witty, be very bright, and impress others. And that's what they're seeking to do. That's very much what they're seeking to do. Now, they're seeking to do it at the beginning of the play, by closing themselves off from the world, okay? We begin with a removal. This is the stuff of comedy. This is the stuff of pure comedy. And by that I mean, just very quickly, running through the comic, what is basic comic structure. Comedy always begins with some sort of conflict. Comedy, tragedy, you name it. Drama is the stuff of conflict. So if you're going to have a good drama of any kind, you have to start with conflict. And comedy almost always begins with a conflict that is social in nature. Now, what is interesting is very often in comedy, that social conflict is between young lovers and an older generation that's trying to prevent them from finding their happiness. That is a standard comic pattern. Because what you have there is personal desire, what I want, as opposed to what society, that is my parents, are demanding that I do. Okay? It is desire versus duty. It is a standard comic problem. You find it almost in almost every comedy ever written. This is a curiosity. The play from the beginning is peculiar in a sense, in that it begins with a reversal. Love's Labor's Lost begins with a group of young men who are insisting on doing their duty by giving up what they desire. If you will, we begin with a group of young men who are attempting to appear aged and wise. The conflict at the beginning of this play is a conflict really between, as we see it at first, learning and love. They are leaving the affections that should go out into the world. They are removing themselves from that, and they are going to a place where they can isolate themselves, control their desires, impose restrictions and order on themselves, and in doing so, free their intellects. Now, it's interesting. The king speaks at the very beginning of the play, defining what it is they're about to do. And it's a noble attempt. It's very valiant. They are going to remove themselves. They are going to do something extraordinary. They're going to do something never done before. Let fame, that all hunt after in their lives, live registered upon our brazen tombs, and then grace us in the disgrace of death. When, spite of cormorant devouring time, the endeavor of this present breath may buy that honor which shall bait his scythe's keen edge and make us heirs of all eternity. The first clue that there's something a little suspect here is that they're going off on their own in order to form what he will call a little academy. Our court shall be a little academe, still and contemplative in living art. It's going to be a remarkable place of study, but they are doing it for fame. Let fame live registered upon our tombs. And they're doing it as young men looking forward to the day of their death, when at the time of death they will have glorious encomiums written in their praise. What extraordinary men these were, who pulled themselves away from the world, lived apart, did extraordinary. What did they do? Well, we're not sure, but they were famous. And this is what's happening here. The focus. The king doesn't really talk about what they're going to do. They're going to study and study and study. We know what they're not going to do. They're not going to eat much. They're not going to sleep much. They're not going to see women. They are going to study. But nobody ever says to what end. Study what? For what purpose? They don't ask this question because the king, who is their leader, who is in charge, has already told them why they're going to do this. To be famous. Because nobody else has done it. And what we have, and it's a gentle little joke, but it's Shakespeare's recognition of one of the ways in which youth works, is youth wants to be noticed. Youth wants to be special. Youth doesn't just want to be like everybody else. And they are willing to go through a lot. They will put up with suffering. They will put up with loss. They will do without the food. They will do without the sleep. They will do without the ladies. Because they will be famous. And fame is better than any of the rest of it. They're swearing oaths to this. The play makes very clear. You've got to be careful what you swear an oath to. The oaths they are swearing are oaths that they cannot possibly keep. Their plan is half-baked. The end of this bright idea is a wrong end. We don't do what we do. We don't accomplish what we accomplish. We don't live our lives for fame. Fame doesn't come that way. Fame comes quite unlooked for and often comes by surprise, and the best example I can think of is our author himself, who clearly can mock this because he himself was not seeking fame. Shakespeare only saw into print two works in his entire life, The Rape of Lucrece and Venus and Adonis. Those are the only two works of his he ever saw through the press and saw printed. I would guess most of you have never heard of either one. And if that's all he had written that we knew about, you wouldn't have heard of him. The fact of the matter is, you know him because of Romeo and Juliet and Hamlet. You know him because of Twelfth Night and The Merchant of Venice. But he never saw those works into print. And in fact, if it had not been for actor friends of his who, after his death, put together the folio, put together the collected works, we wouldn't have close to half the plays. Because Shakespeare didn't bother. Shakespeare was a practical man of the theater, writing plays for a company in which he was part owner, trying to make a living, trying to raise a family, trying to do the best work he could. If you had told him that 400 years from now, later, he would be viewed not just as the greatest of English playwrights, not just as the greatest of English poets, but probably the greatest poet playwright who ever lived, he probably would have chuckled and thought that was just hyperbole. You really were exaggerating. And if you'd gone up to the man on the street in Shakespeare's day and said, who's the greatest writer now living? They would have said, without exception, Ben Jonson. Ben Jonson. No doubt about it. Oh, rare Ben Jonson's the boy. He's the one. Very intelligent. He's studied at universities. He's studied his Latin. He writes these polished plays. And Ben Jonson's a fine writer. I don't mean to take anything away from him. He and Shakespeare were friendly rivals their whole lives. But the first one to recognize that Shakespeare was indeed going to get fame was Ben Jonson, who wrote a beautiful elegy called To My Beloved Master, William Shakespeare, and What He Hath Left Us. And in that gorgeous elegy of genuine respect comes the line, and it's a knockout, and Ben was the first one to catch on to it. He was not of an age, but for all time. And that's a great truth. We just take it for granted now. In Shakespeare's own time, nobody took that for granted. Very few people would have believed it. Shakespeare himself certainly would not have believed it. But Ben Jonson was right. The works of Shakespeare transcend time and place and are a great gift that has been given to all of humanity. But he didn't seek that out. He was busy writing plays. King of Navarre is seeking fame. Let fame, that all hunt after in their lives, live registered upon our brazen tombs and then grace us in the disgrace of death. When death comes and takes us away, when we go to dust, let us have the grace of fame? No, no, no. No, no, no. And it's very clear from the beginning that we have a misstep here. Now, of course, what Shakespeare does is put one gentleman in the group who has a hint of this. Okay? Barone, who's the most interesting of the four young men, has a sense that there's something not quite right here, and he's the one who starts protesting. He's there. He's with them. He agreed to come along. He indeed, yeah, he'll sign this, but he doesn't really want to sign it. And he's complaining. Okay? He's the burr under their academic saddle. And he's causing them some discomfort. And he himself is not quite sure why, other than the fact that there's something very curious here, and he doesn't like it. Act 1, Scene 1. They just sign their oaths. And he's protesting, saying, well, I'll go along with you, but I'm not sure about this. They just sign the oaths, which means they should instantly get down to study. And what we find out is that the French king's daughter has arrived to speak with the king of Navarre. Bad timing, okay? And the king himself says, I love it, line 139, what say you, Lord's wife? This was quite forgot. It's... the first thing that the king has forgotten is practical business matters. I'm sorry. He still has diplomatic relations still have to go on. And sure enough, it's not just the Princess of France that shows up, but she's brought her three ladies with her. How convenient. It's a wonderful little Shakespearean joke. It's absolutely delightful. And Barone instantly says, so study evermore is overshot. Okay, we just signed the oath. We're going to study. We're going to study hard. We're not going to sleep. We're not going to eat. No women. Oh, here come the women. Well, there goes the study. And it happens that quickly. It happens that quickly. And then he says, while it doth study to have what it would, it doth forget to do the thing it should. He's smart. He's got good horse sense, we call it here in the Midwest. Good horse sense. But he himself does not understand the clear implications of what he's saying. Because he himself is going to have some tough lessons to learn throughout the course of the play. But it's absolutely correct. And of course, he says it in a wonderful little couplet. And when it hath the thing it hunteth most, 'tis won as towns with fire. So won, so lost. Okay. It's an image of battle. And of course, what's about to go on is the greatest of all the battles, the battle between the young men and the young women. It's the classic battle. Okay. It's in social terms, sort of the ultimate battle. But the image is, okay, we got what we wanted, here we are, we're doing what we want to do, and it's the same thing as, we will win that town, we'll take that town, how are we going to do it? I have an idea, we'll burn it to the ground. There it is. It's gone, and now it's ours. Okay? It's an uproariously funny image. But again, in case we didn't get it, the king says, we must of course dispense with this decree. She must lie here on mere necessity. We don't choose to have them here. We don't want them here. They've shown up. This is necessity. What can we do? This is gentle humor. It's wonderful humor. It's again what I call the humor of human foibles. We are seeing young men being young men, and young men are often foolish in their idealism. And there's nothing necessarily wrong with the idealism except, we see it from the beginning of the play, it's not connected with reality. Idealism can only live and flourish and accomplish anything if it is connected, no, better yet, rooted in reality. There is a real world out there. And for these young men, the real world is a world where you make your oath, but a lady, a princess, is going to show up with her three attendants, and suddenly your plans are going to be overturned. Barone continues, necessity will make us all forsworn 3,000 times within this 3 years' space. Look, if you're going to start making that argument now based on necessity, we're never going to get anything done. You want necessity. Life is nonstop necessity. And what that is, simply, again, the realistic view of how we live life. Necessity. Eating is a necessity. Sleep is a necessity. Having beautiful ladies around and going to talk with them is a necessity. Okay? And Barone goes on to make this point, which is, for every man with his affects is born, not by might mastered, but by special grace. It's a glorious little phrase. It's packed with wisdom. There is wisdom in these young men. We can mock them. We can laugh at them. Fact of the matter is, they are bright. They are intelligent. Look, we're born with these effects. We're born with these emotions. We're born with these desires. We've come out here and we're going to try to hammer them, absolutely brutalize them into subservience. Barone is saying, that's not how you do it. It won't work. Not by might mastered. I will not sleep. I will not sleep. I will not sleep. I'll not sleep. Yeah, okay. I can keep saying that, okay? And as I get sleepy, knock myself on the head with a hammer to stay awake. I won't sleep. I won't, except eventually I'm going to literally knock myself out. You cannot master the effects by might, but rather by special grace. Now, this is a play filled with wordplay. And that coming of the word grace so soon after the king had used it at the beginning about the grace of death coming into nonsense, not disgraceful death. We have a very different vision here. And indeed, this is something that we're going to see throughout the play. This is not a specifically religious play, but once again, we have Shakespeare's mind just filled with faith. And what he knows is, if we're going to accomplish any of these things, if we're going to be able to overcome those desires, there's only one way we master the passions, and that's by special grace. Not by closing ourselves off, not by shutting ourselves away. Baron has some good sense, okay? Well, the ladies show up, and it's very clear what's going to happen. We more or less know the rest of the play. This is the only play Shakespeare ever wrote that doesn't have a source. All of his other plots he stole. He took from somewhere else. This is the only one that does not have a source of any kind. He apparently, as far as we know, invented it. It was fairly easy to invent. I'll take four young men and then I'll introduce four young women. Yeah, well, you've got a plot. You know, we've got a story that will make things run. It will work. They show up, and of course, it's very clear what's going to happen, but I want to point something out, and this is quite lovely, and it's knowledge that Shakespeare had from the start. The young men are filled with high idealism to the point of foolishness. The women, from the start, are down to earth, realistic, and know why they're there and what they're after. Shakespeare's women almost always, if they are good women, are rooted in that reality. But the reality comes to them, the sense comes to them, the intelligence, the wit, the goodness comes to them by grace. Shakespeare's women have a real beauty about them. It is the beauty of innocence and the knowledge, the wisdom that comes from innocence. There is wisdom in the innocent heart. And Shakespeare's women have that to a high degree. It's a complaint I've had for years, and it's one of the problems in doing the comedies now. I've spoken to His Excellency about this. It is difficult to cast the young women in Shakespeare's plays. The sad fact of the matter is that given the state of the world, and given what goes on in the theater, it is very difficult to find young actresses who can convey that innocence on the stage. It is extremely difficult to cast these roles. In the production you saw last night, I particularly like the young woman who plays the princess. She has a very slight speech defect, just a tiny one, but I found her performance particularly lovely in that way. Intelligence, softness, there was something very nice about her. These women have to convey that sort of innocence in order for the plays to work. Because that reality, that sense of being down to earth, is not earthiness. It is rather an acceptance in the heart and the soul of the way things are. It is, if you will, young women who, in their innocence, are in accord with God's providential plan. And that is, they are there in the world to love and be loved, to give themselves to a man, and in doing so, fulfill their mission. And that mission comes in marriage. They know this. There is no sense here that these young women would be locked, that would go off and lock themselves away and form a sewing club and not let anyone in. Okay? It simply would not happen. What is going on in the play is very much a temptation of young men. Why? Because it touches the male, that most monstrous of all things, the male ego. It's a terrible thing. It's a terrible thing. And the male ego wants attention. Wants to stand out. Wants to be noticed. It's in us. It's an awful thing. It takes, what does it take? You can't master it by might, but by special grace. It can be controlled. In the play, the women show up, and please notice the first thing that happens is that the king is discourteous. He will not let them in. They are not allowed into his palace. They are not allowed to walk his grounds. And in fact, he says, look, I'll house you in a tent out here in the field. Now, there's a wonderful little joke in that. You know, that's how men in battle get housed. Okay, we'll set up a special tent, we'll live outside. Well, this is a battle going on. The warriors have shown up. They're quite lovely. It's a different kind of battle. They're different warriors. But there is that sense of, well, we'll put you in tents out there in the field. And we'll come and talk to you occasionally when we feel like it. But on a more profound level, and this cannot be ignored, they are discourteous. They have begun their little academy, and what is happening? Already they are cutting themselves off from the most basic human obligations. I'm sorry. If a princess and three of her ladies show up, then you treat them well, and you don't say, we'll put up a tent for you, you can sleep out in the parking lot. That is and again, what we see happening is, through this obsession with what I can do, what I can accomplish, what I must do because it is my part to bring something new into the world, to bring fame for myself and those around me into the world, to separate myself from there is nothing wrong in separation from the world if it's for the right reason. But the point is they are not doing it for the right reason. They have not thought it through to the point where they understand it, and they have not done the first necessary thing when you embark on any such project, and that is mistrust the self. They are just assuming it's all fine. There is no mistrust in them. And because of that, because of their sureness, they almost immediately start doing that which they shouldn't do. And that is just simple discourtesy, which will grow through the play until they become positively foolish and then cruel. I'll follow this pattern because it's an important one. What begins with a small misstep grows tenfold during the course of the play until finally they are in a position that is not enviable at all. And in a way, they need the ending that the play delivers because the play cannot end where we would like it to end. It's not possible, given what these young men have become. They have hard lessons they must learn, and they must learn them in a hard way, and they're going to. Now, they go out to woo, and of course we get the flamboyance of language. They instantly fall in love. I don't need to go through the obvious. It is enjoyable to watch. It's delightful. What is happening is that nature, the reality of nature, is taking over from the phony idealism of the head. But they have no real way to express this because from the beginning they're torn. They cannot woo properly because they have made an oath against such activity. They cannot use language properly because they have to mask what they're feeling. They cannot openly, okay, the wonderful business of the letters. You know, Baron cannot simply write a letter and straightforwardly present it to Rosaline. Reason being, he'll be mocked by his fellow students. Therefore, he has to send it secretly, and he sends it through an idiot who can't even read the addresses on the envelopes. And you get the wonderful joke of Costard delivering Don Armado's letter to Jaquinetta to Rosaline, okay? And Jaquinetta getting this letter that's supposed to go to Rosaline, who has no idea what it means. And of course, the trick comes back. His attempt to hide ends up being the way in which he's revealed. It makes sense. Nor can he necessarily use language properly. And this is the language here is artificial. The language here is delightful. The language is very polished. The language is elevated. But the language is hiding something. These young men are hiding behind their language because they're so smart, they can use it well, and they can use their language to protect them, protect themselves. And in a way, you get the difficult problem of what happens again, the ego seeking fame that can use words, but using it in order to promote the self, not to connect, not to say what needs to be said. Language that will not land where it's supposed to land, do the work it's supposed to do, it cannot connect because it is there to show off. And they're brilliant. They really are brilliant. The rest of us can't speak this way. The rest of us cannot come up with sonnets extempore. We can't do it, okay? But there's a danger in that. And the first danger comes in the first of the comic subplots. Shakespeare gives us the four men, he gives us their genius, he gives them us their ability to use words, and what do we get simultaneously? Don Armado, who is, if you will, a comic, overblown vision of what they could become, what they're tending toward. And what you have with Don Armado is a man sick with love. He's gone off there with them, and he thinks himself as intelligent as they are. But the king says, we brought him here, he's going to provide amusement for us. We're going to laugh at him. He's foolish. He's essentially a clown, except he is of nobility. He's of an elevated rank. But he is someone who has become so grotesquely overblown, overdone, overdesigned, overdrawn. He has become so exaggerated in all of his emotions, all of his thoughts, that he is simply comic. But the young men don't see that they're looking in a mirror. That is exactly what they're on the verge of becoming. And it's much easier to point the finger and laugh at others than it is to stand before the mirror and see our true selves. So they laugh at Don Armado, and poor Don Armado trying to woo Jaconetta. Poor Don Armado it's one of the missteps in the TV production, by the way. The fellow who plays Mote or Moth, Armado's assistant, should be a little boy. For some reason they cast this older gentleman. You lose the joke. Because part of the joke in the original is that this seemingly grown up man is being bested over and over again by a kid. The kid is much cleverer than the old man, just keeps nailing him over and over. You miss that joke. I don't know why they cast the fellow in the role. But in any case, it's a sense, in the innocent, pure wit of the young boy, the old man, he can't keep up. He doesn't understand. And the reason is he's overdone. He's too much of everything. But he's there for a purpose. And the purpose is he is reflecting one side of what these young gentlemen could become. It's a real danger. If they allowed their love to lack the necessary grace, okay? A love minus true charity. There's a passage in the play. We'll look at it right now. Act 4. Why not do it now since I'm speaking of it? Act 4, scene 3. Theron is speaking. This is a long speech, and it's a speech that pretty clearly was added by Shakespeare when the play was revised. It's an extraordinary piece of work. He begins. It's a long speech. I'm at about line 300. They've all been revealed to each other. Okay, it's the scene where they overhear each other reading the letters. So it's a wonderful little stage piece. It's a good joke. But Biron, who thinks he's gotten away with it, and there, of course, is looking down on all the others, thinking that he is somehow more than they are. And in fact, the very words he uses, I'm going back in the scene. I'm at line 159 now. All three of you, are you not all three of you to be thus much o'ershot? Are you not ashamed? Look at the three of you standing, sending these love letters off. Don't you remember our oaths? Don't you remember what we're supposed to be here for? You found his mote, the king your mote did see, but I a beam do find in each of three. Okay, it's just, you're picking at each other, but I see the gross failings of each one of you. Whereupon Jaconetta and Costard walk in with a letter that he's written to Rosaline. It's just like, oh, okay. And again, please notice all the way through this play, any time any of these gentlemen tries to make something of himself, he just gets flattened. Okay? Shakespeare, it's gentle comedy, but comedy always brings us back down to earth. Comedy won't let us get too pompous. Okay? It's the reason why I've said this before, the fundamental joke is slipping on a banana peel. Because it reminds us we're subject to the laws of gravity. And throughout this play, every time these young men try to advance themselves, try to become more than they should be, try to pump themselves up, there's a little pin that comes and boop, the balloon gets burst and down they go again, okay? Well, it happens to him there. But, again, Barone, being the most intelligent in some ways, gives the lesson. I'm back at line 300. Love, first learned in a lady's eyes, lives not alone immured in the brain, but with the motion of all elements, courses as swift as thought in every power, and gives to every power a double power above their functions and their offices. You cannot do anything without love. Now, at this point in the speech, he's talking about the love that comes from others. He's a young man, so it's expressed in terms of the love of the young woman. But what Shakespeare is talking about is that we can do nothing if we do not take as the source of our activity love of others. And that love of the other will give a double power to every power we have. It's what infuses it, if you will, and makes it something genuine. Now, I'm at the end of the very same speech. I'm at line 330, and he's saying, you know, that women's eyes are the books, the arts, the academes that show, contain, and nourish all the world, else none at all in aught proves excellent. You cannot pull yourselves away, he's saying. Again, we're using women's eyes, but what the women's eyes stand for is what's in the world, the necessities of the world, that which draws us into the world and makes us live a day-to-day life, a real life. It'd be wonderful to pull away and have our little, you know, can't do it. Because if we're going to know anything, understand anything, connect in any way, then we have to connect. How? We have to connect through what's out there, through what's real. Then fools were these women to forswear, or keeping what is sworn, you will prove fools. For wisdom's sake, a word that all men love, or for love's sake, a word that loves all men, or for men's sake, the authors of these women, or women's sake, by whom we men are men, let us lose our oaths to find ourselves, or else we lose ourselves to keep our oaths. It is religion to be thus forsworn. For charity itself fulfills the law, and who can sever love from charity? Whew. Just wonderful. It is somehow uncharitable to have pulled themselves out of the world. They were seeking to be a little world complete unto themselves. When their real obligation, because it is a necessity, is to be moving in the world with charity, but moving in the world with charity infuses to everything they do a double power and will make them able to accomplish much more than they ever could have done by removing themselves from that world. Okay? Now, in the realm of love, that charity is what keeps their love from becoming like Don Armato. That is excessive, foolish love of self, in which it is self-display and ostentation of language. I won't go through some of the letters he writes or some of his speeches you saw. It's funny stuff. It's very funny stuff. But he has no sense of it. He cannot see himself, much less can he see the others around him. Okay? He simply doesn't know. He doesn't comprehend.